Hello, my name is Chip Lang. You are listening to Total EM. The podcast today is one that is kind of confusing when you think about it because it's about being awake and dead. Yes, those are two things we don't usually put together, but they do actually exist. This sometimes comes up as alertness and cardiac arrest, although what I've seen more literature call it is cardiopulmonary resuscitation-induced consciousness, or CPRIC. No matter what you want to call it, this is a rare event. And since it is so rare, it's also hard to figure out how we should manage these patients best. We're going to talk about what literature is out there, at least some of the key ones I found. And if you know some other really good stuff, please send it my way. I'd be happy to talk about it as well. But we're going to talk about some of the key pieces of literature, how it kind of ties into maybe some ways in how to manage these patients. Keep in mind, with as limited evidence as there is, there probably isn't going to be any magic fix. But what I do want to talk about is what we can do to help with this rare phenomenon. The first point is that these patients tend to have better outcomes. And so we don't want to ignore the fact CPRIC exists. In fact, what we want to talk about is how we can improve the odds. In one university hospital in Italy, over the course of a little over 2 years, they found 6 cases of this event. And the really neat thing was that 4 out of the 6 people achieved ROSC, and all of them had a neurologically intact survival with hospital discharge. This is huge because we're talking about patients that, you know, these are people who are doing some sort of purposeful movements to some degree, like attempting to remove the ET tube, or they're talking even. But these are patients where there's different ways to manage them. And in this trial, they did just that. And in this study, they found that CPR lasted anywhere from 4 to 30 minutes, and that they used basically everything from just physical restraint all the way up to inducing them with like fentanyl or propofol or something along those lines. The interesting part with that is there was really no standardization, even though they're going through this kind of more of a retrospective investigation. But again, it's key because we should keep in mind these patients have a high likelihood of survival. Something else we want to keep in mind is this prospective study that came up in 2014 known as AWARE, and it discussed awareness and resuscitation with 140 survivors of cardiac arrest. The really interesting part was 55 of those interviewed had perceptions of awareness and or memories even of these events. A little caveat and something that's worth mentioning is that only one of them had a verifiable period of consciousness in a time that they shouldn't have during their arrest, but it is still something that is well worth looking at the paper itself because this wasn't like little things that these other people are recalling besides that one that was verifiable. There were actually 2, but the other one they couldn't verify. So only one of the 140 had a verifiable awareness. But again, for all these others, they are having nightmares, they're having dreams of some kind, they're having some form of recollection, which leads to complications down the line, such as post-traumatic stress disorder or PTSD to develop. Now we got to figure out how are we going to manage these patients? And before we really get into that, there was a systematic review that was performed where in 2014, they went through, you know, basically 10 different patients in 9 different reports with resuscitations lasting up to 280 minutes, that's 4 hours and 40 minutes, and still survived to hospital discharge. Those patients had all different types of awareness, anything from, again, you know, purposeful movements like trying to move an ET tube to verbal communication, and some were even interfering with resuscitation itself. But they really didn't come up with anything other than saying, hey, we probably need some guidelines on this. So this leads to another paper, this observational study in 2017 that focused on Victoria, Australia, where they took the registry from January 2008 to December 2014. And out of 16,558 cardiac arrest patients, they found 112 cases of CPRIC, which is about 2/3 of 1%. They found a lot of different things that I think are really interesting for an observational study. Again, you have to keep in mind this is extremely limited, but they've got some interesting stuff. One was that 87.5% had body movement. So most of these patients will have some form of movement as their CPRIC. But there are even up to almost 30% of patients having speech. So they're talking in some way. And this can be really kind of scary and confusing when you have a patient who's yelling at you to get off their chest, and you get off their chest because you think they've gotten ROSC, but they actually didn't. They go right back to the rest. So they're perfusing so well that they actually think and can communicate and talk to you. But as soon as you quit chest compressions, they're dead again. They've lost all consciousness and they've been in a rest the whole time. They haven't actually achieved return to spontaneous circulation, ROSC. So these are patients where there were different ways in how people were managing them. Some of them was simply restraints. So they, you know, tied them down kind of thing, and that was the end of it. I'm not a huge fan of that because, again, talking about the AWARE trial, this probably isn't helping with end results. But they tried some other things. You know, in some cases, people used midazolam, some used opiates, some used paralytics. It's worth noting that there was a statistically significant difference in the likelihood of survival to hospital discharge versus using medication versus the general population. So technically, looking at that paper, it make you think, oh, well, if I give medications, they have a higher risk of not surviving to hospital discharge. You have to keep in mind, this is observational and a retrospective study. So there are lots of issues with it. And really, I think some of them are things we can tease out, and I'll talk about it here more in a second, maybe why this happened. But I don't want that to scare you away and to think that, oh, we really shouldn't give these patients medications. There was a different study in 2016 where they did a cross-sectional survey of 100 healthcare professionals, and a lot of them had noticed this event. Now, these are people who are very experienced. Again, read the paper to kind of get the details, but these are not spring chickens. They have done a lot, seen a lot, and they all had different ways on how to approach these patients, from doing nothing to sedation to paralysis. So again, we don't really have a great consensus. Now, there are two guidelines exist currently that I find very interesting, and there's other guidelines out there. I'd be curious to see what they are too. One is from the Wellington Free Ambulance in New Zealand, and then another is from the state of Nebraska EMS. Both push for the idea of ketamine and midazolam. I find this very interesting because when we talk about these patients, really what we're noticing with them is that maybe some of these outcomes that we're finding are negative outcomes from these medications, not necessarily because of maybe the medication itself, but how we're giving it, you know, if we're giving too much, and also possibly because of some of the pharmacodynamics of these medications. Let's think about it like this. So opiates and benzos like midazolam, they could be causing, you know, problems down the line once you get ROSC or if you get ROSC, because of what these patients are going to have their body go through. They may take away some of the, you know, effects that our body's trying to do to help us survive, because again, they're, you know, to keep it simple, they're downers. You know, they're going to help decrease function. And especially when you're talking about paralytics, they're not really fixing anything. Yeah, their patient's not going to move, but they're still going to have recollection. So you're not really fixing anything there. Yeah, they're going to stop moving on you, stop reaching for the tube. But these patients really probably need sedation, proper sedation at that, which is why I like that they mentioned ketamine. Because ketamine is going to control the pain and sedation needed for cardiac arrest. And you can give very small amounts because, again, these patients are pretty sick. So if you try and give these patients high doses of fentanyl or midazolam during the middle of their arrest, you're probably not winning yourself any favors there. You're probably actually going to do some of that harm that could be going on, as we noticed in that one retrospective study. But I think the ketamine is going to also be beneficial for the catecholamine effects that you're getting there. Now, again, you need to use as little as possible just so you can avoid some of the deleterious effects. But even if you get ROSC back afterwards, and you were to say need some more sedation, yeah, you've got the option of you can give some more ketamine if you want. But also you could potentially give these people midazolam then. And that might be nice because they may get some of the loss of recollection that they could have had with the ketamine. Because if you've used ketamine, you're kind of familiar with the fact that these patients can sometimes recall some weird dreams or stuff like that. And if we're trying to avoid the whole PTSD issue, maybe we add some midazolam with it. But I encourage you to use small, small doses of midazolam, just like you use small, small doses of ketamine. So with that in mind, the ketamine may be a better one to at least start with. Maybe you do some midazolam if you need to, but give small, small doses of this. Some other things that I think are worth mentioning I haven't already talked about yet. When we talk about CPRIC, these are usually patients who are receiving mechanical compressions versus manual compressions by a healthcare professional of some kind. But as I've gone through this research, that kind of bias and reports that I saw in other media where they talk about it being a lot of times mechanical, such as, for example, and again, no affiliations with any of this. No, I'm not paid for them in any way. No financial disclosures, but like the Lucas devices, for example, you know, Lucas 2 was actually kind of cited a lot by a bunch of different people, just like seeing this more often. Maybe it's just because of the quality of CPR, just when you have that. But even with good quality CPR, not with mechanical compressions like the Lucas devices, we are still seeing this come up. So this is something to keep in mind, that good traditional compressions can still get the same effect. We don't necessarily only see this with these devices. So if you're working a rural ED like mine that doesn't have this kind of stuff yet, still expect to see it. Now, it's worth noting that since I've gone over this research about a year ago and just kind of getting more and more data and thinking about how I would manage this myself, I haven't really got to see this yet. I'd be curious how people are using it, and I really would hope that there'd be some sort of newer, better trial that would include ketamine, just to see if my thoughts are true. But right now, there's really nothing other than basically a couple of different groups suggesting using this on their guidelines. But again, when you think about it, the details, ketamine probably is going to be a good option, plus or minus midazolam. I think that's something that you're just going to have to decide on based on the situation. But if you are going to use these medications, probably smaller amounts and work your way up. So with that in mind, again, I really would like to know your feedback, your thoughts on this issue. And if you have better research out there, mention that too. But the best way that we could go about this is that the next step really is doing a randomized control trial. But I don't see that happening, at least not for a very, very long time. Because again, this is a rare event. We're talking about 2/3 of 1%, at least in the Victoria, Australia cohort. And when we see this, I mean, that's going to be really hard to actually properly randomize it. So I don't think this is something we're going to see, at least not anytime in the near future, unless something were to change. But it's still really intriguing. And like I said, I'd love to see some research where we actually use ketamine in it, just to see if that does have any benefit versus using opiates or the paralytics, which I really don't think the paralytics are going to help you out. And really should only be used to be an adjunct for other things going on. The opiates could be interesting, but again, I think I'd rather wait after the arrest, and we've got ROSC if we need to for pain control as part of sedation. But I think ketamine makes a lot more sense. And again, maybe midazolam in the right circumstances, but you got to be very careful with that. Would love to hear your thoughts. And this is all stuff that, again, is very cutting edge. So we got to take all this with a grain of salt. Definitely want to talk to your colleagues out there, see what they're thinking. They've probably seen this too, especially if they've been practicing for a while. Like I said, I haven't got to see any of these since I have come across this. And I think my plans are to go ahead and use ketamine, like I've talked about. But let me know what your thoughts are. Please tell me. We'd be curious to hear other stories out there, especially if people have come across this multiple times, especially if they now started using ketamine with it, just to know what it's like and if this really does seem to be that beneficial. But until next time, continue to provide total care everywhere.